The following presentation was produced by the Buddhist Society of Victoria. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
And just to very briefly recap, what we're looking at is the 37 body Pratyadhamma, the 37 aids to awakening, the 7 sets of various factors of the path. The first set we're looking at is the 4 life efforts. That is what we're looking at now. And the 4 life efforts being the effort to restrain, the effort to give up, the effort to develop, and the effort to maintain. I think that these 4 right efforts that we find here. And we have already looked at the idea of restraining, and the point I was making is that restraint happens mostly to understanding the problems of these things that we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid in particular ill will, and also desire to some extent if we can, and I'll talk more about this later on. And you do that through a sense of wisdom. That wisdom is really just understand that these things are not satisfactory, that they lead to problems, they lead to suffering, they lead to all kinds of problems. And once you get that in a deep sense, it's actually relatively easy to restrain. You don't have to do very much. All you have to do is remind yourself that these things are problematic. And once you remind yourself, it's like mind withdraws from those things because you understand it's not a place where you're going to find any happiness or any satisfaction. So you withdraw from that. So it's quite simple. It's simple in one way, but it's difficult in the sense that you really understand that ill will, even ill will, is always problematic and has negative consequences. That actually is the hard part. And you need to reflect on that. And especially when it comes to desires for the sensory world, it's quite difficult to, not maybe difficult, but it takes a lot of patience and practice and reflection to really understand that these things too are problematic. They don't give any real satisfaction. They're always going to let you down at the end of the day. I'm going to talk more about this later on. And then as you deepen that insight and understanding, then restraint happens almost automatically. All you have to do is remind yourself of the problem. And then the mind withdraws and pulls away from those areas where it sees a degree of danger, I suppose, that degree of suffering, whatever it is. So the next one of these 4 right efforts is the effort to give up. It is similar to the idea of restraining, except that now the problem has already arisen, and I have to sort of abandon it once it has come into being. Okay, so this is how it goes. And what mendicant is the effort to give up? It's when a mendicant does not tolerate a sensual, malicious, or cruel thought that has arisen there, but gives it up and gets rid of it, eliminates it, and obliterates it. They don't tolerate any bad, unskillful qualities that have arisen, but give them up, get rid of them, eliminate them, and obliterate them. This is called the effort to give up. Yeah, so if you have some kind of bad thoughts arisen in your mind, then what you do is you obliterate it. Interesting, isn't it? You obliterate bad thoughts. And this calls for a bit of comment, because what does it mean to obliterate a thought? How can you possibly obliterate a thought? How does this actually happen? This is kind of the critical thing to understand here, because it's far from obvious how you can obliterate the thought. You can maybe suppress it, you can push it out of your mind. The obliteration is not actually very obvious how that is to be done. But first of all, what is the meaning of the unwholesome thoughts here? You have sensual thoughts, and that is obviously just craving for any kind of sensual object. Yeah, anything in the realm of the 5 senses that we crave for is a sensual thought. Malicious really means just ill will, anger and all of those kind of things, including also irritation, the whole kind of spectrum of ill will, from very mild to very coarse. And then the last one here is perhaps the most interesting one. Adam Sujata translated as cruel here. And the word means something, it's the Bihinsa, it is the same word that was used by Gandhi. He had the Abhihinsa or Ahinsa movement in India, which was a movement without cruelty, without harm. It was like being harmless. This word here, which is translated as cruel here, it can also be translated as being harmful, perhaps, or being ruthless, not really considering the other people and how you live your life, just kind of going about your life without really thinking about how it affects other beings, walking through the forest and stepping on all the little animals and ants and whatever, without really worrying about what happens to other beings. It's like being ruthless. And the word ruthless in English, the word ruth, means compassion. That's the original meaning of that word. So ruthless means without compassion. It's a person who doesn't really care about other people's feelings. You are insensitive to the world around you, kind of cold to other beings. That's really what this comes down to. So cruel is just one aspect of that, but it's kind of slightly wider than that. It's difficult to translate into English precisely, because ruthless also doesn't really necessarily include all the aspects. It doesn't really include cruelty, ruthlessness, but all of these things are part of this thing we call the vihinsa, or hinsa in the Pali language. So these are the bad thoughts. And then, towards the end there, it says that you don't tolerate any bad, unskillful qualities. And of course, bad, unskillful qualities, they go beyond the mere. The ones that you have here are the main ones, sexual desire, ill will, and cruelty. But of course, there are many more. And when you read the sutra, they're talking about the five hindrances, for example, which include things like tiredness and lethargy. It includes restlessness and remorse, and even doubt is considered an unskillful quality in Buddhism. And of course, they are also sort of included here. They're also part of this. So that also is to be considered when you look at these things. So why aren't they mentioned? Why are they just kind of lumped together into one category called unskillful qualities? And the main reason for that is because all the other unskillful qualities that you may have, sometimes tiredness is just natural, you had a long day and you need to sleep or whatever. But sometimes tiredness and lethargy, the bad type of tiredness, the bad type of restlessness, these things, they actually come from desire, they come from ill will. These are the things that lead to these problems. And it's very easy to understand why that must be the case, because if you desire things, that natural desire leads you to act. It makes you restless. It makes you want to do things to fulfill those desires. Yeah? It's kind of obvious. Or if you have a lot of ill will, you often feel tired afterwards. Tiredness comes often from these defilements. The same thing with sensuality. You pursue those sensual pleasures, and they never really live up to the billing. They never really ask. Great as it's supposed to be, never really given contentment and happiness, and you feel a bit tired afterwards because you have used your mind. You might have been restless, agitated, trying to pursue these things. So a lot of these other unskillful qualities, they are derived from desire and ill will. Desire and ill will are the root unwholesome qualities. So if you focus on those, the other ones tend to kind of follow along and also disappear. And in fact, the one root defilement that is the cause of everything else we live in is desire. Sensual desire is the root. Because ill will also very often comes about because of sensual desire. Then you desire something, the desire is thwarted, and you don't get what you want, and you become angry because other people stand in the way of your happiness and your pleasures in life, and you get upset with them as a consequence. So really, if there is a root defilement, is desire is a root thing. But dealing with anger is more easy, and that's why I recommend that. In fact, you could go even further. You could say that the root of all the problems is not really even desire. The root of all the problems actually is delusion. Because delusion is what tells us that these things are worthy of pursuit. We should pursue these kind of things, but actually, because they don't really bring any happiness. They're not really worthy of pursuit at all. It's just the delusion of the mind that tells us that these things are worthy of pursuit. But delusion is too profound. You can't deal with delusion, direct delusion in that. You have to deal with it indirectly, and that's why you start off with dealing with ill will, and to some extent with desires. And then when these defilements die down, then delusion also gradually is reduced as a consequence of that. These things kind of die down together. Until one day, when the mind is very pure and very rid of all these defilements, then we can also eliminate delusion itself. So this is why we focus on these qualities. And of course, if you think of a large number of mental defilements, someone mentioned jealousy here the other day, and you can think of maybe things like conceit or things like you can easily come up with envy or whatever, a large number of mental defilements. But all of these tend to be rooted in ill will and desire. And so deal with that, we're dealing with the whole lot, basically, and that's why they are mentioned in this white head. So how then do we do this? As I said, you look at the words that are used here, you get rid of them, you obliterate them. Then when you read that, it sounds like you're taking out the sledgehammer and kind of crushing these things with the sledgehammer. But be careful with that sledgehammer, because the sledgehammer often leads to problems. Yeah, it destroys too much and it causes big problems because you're using too much force, really. That is the problem here. So again, the idea of how to obliterate the unwholesome qualities is not by using brute force, using ill will, but certainly using willpower. That doesn't really work. And it doesn't work because, as I mentioned before, willpower tends to suppress them. And once they are suppressed, then often they come back again later on with a vengeance. Also, it doesn't work because using willpower takes a lot of energy. Takes a lot of, if you feel really tired after a while, if you use willpower all the time. And you know that is the case because when you go to work, you have a long day at work, you come back home, and sometimes you feel exhausted. Yeah, because you have to focus, you have to put your attention onto writing things and reading things. And sometimes it may not be entirely fun either, but you're kind of boring and you have to force yourself to do things. And you feel tired. And you feel exhausted because of that. And that is because you have to use willpower. Willpower exhausts you, makes you tired. So it's not really sustainable. After a while, you just have to give up. And then, of course, the defilements really come back again as a consequence. So this is why willpower is not really ideal. There are certain situations where you have to use willpower. Like when you are just about to murder somebody. Then use willpower, don't murder anyone. It's not a good idea to murder other people, because you're going to feel really bad about yourself afterwards if you murder somebody. It's a very difficult thing to do, to kill another person. So there are times to use willpower when kind of things are really getting out of hand, but generally speaking, you try to use wisdom power instead. So when these things arise, what is that wisdom power? And it is the same kind of wisdom power that you use to restrain yourself. You remember that these things, they are a cause of suffering. They are suffering in themselves, and they also lead to suffering in the future. They are problematic. They take you away from the path. They make wisdom cease. It says in one of the sutras, it's very nice. This is from the Veda Vitaka, this sutra, the Majjhimanikaya Middle-aged Saint number 19. And it says that the defilements, they are panya nirodhika. Panya nirodhika literally means wisdom ceasing. They cause wisdom to cease. And they lead to trouble. They lead away from nirvana. Nirvana lead away from peace, in other words. Lead away from things ceasing, coming to an end. So they are all of these things. And when you get that in a deep way, that these things really are troublesome, they really are suffering, again, the mind just withdraws automatically. If you don't get it fully, the mind withdraws a little bit. So you develop that perception of the danger in these things and the problem, and then you can turn your mind in a different direction. So my job on this retreat is to show you a little bit about why these things are dangerous, why they are problematic, we'll look more at that later on, and then to help you to kind of move away from that. With anger, it's fairly easy to see why it's problematic. It leads to so many problems in this world. With the sensual pleasures, it's more difficult. But it is not that difficult, and we'll get back to that very soon, actually. Yeah. So that is the right effort concerned with giving up. Okay? You give up those things that are bad, lead to suffering, and are problematic. And then we have the next one, which is the right effort to develop. This is the bhavana. And it goes as follows. And what mendicant is the right effort to develop? It is when a mendicant develops the awakening factor of mindfulness, the awakening factor of investigation of principles, the awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of rapture, the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of immersion, the awakening factor of equanimity, which rely on seclusion, rely on fading away, rely on cessation, and ripen as letting go. This is called the effort to develop. So there you have this word immersion. You know what immersion is? Any idea? Immersion is samadhi. You define it as concentration or stillness. And when you see the word immersion, there's only one person in the whole world who translates samadhi as immersion. Not Adam Sujato, especially right now, it's Adam Sujato. I don't know, it's nice, it kind of gets to the point of what samadhi is, if you are immersed in the experience, it kind of gets to the point. But I must admit, I don't quite like it personally, for me it's a little bit too technical and too intellectual perhaps. I prefer something more, has more kind of emotional, isn't it related to emotion, like stillness, for example, straight away, you know what it feels like, you know what it is. Immersion lacks that kind of, to my mind, that kind of sense of, doesn't really, you can't relate to it quite in the same way. But it has its advantages and its disadvantages, I suppose. Anyway, so these are the awakening factors. So these are the things that we are supposed to develop. Make them come into existence. And as I mentioned before, one of the critical things here to make come into existence is this whole nexus here of mindfulness, energy, and rapture. These things are very closely related to each other, and very often they arise together. The way to make these things arise is often to develop what we call the recollections. The things that make you enjoy the present moment. It can be the recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, Chaga, generosity, all of these kind of things. Or just enjoying being here on this retreat, kind of doing something which is nice and positive with other good companions, all of these kind of things. That is what the development of good qualities is. So the first part of right effort is about how to avoid and eliminate bad qualities. Now it is about giving rise to and developing good qualities, is the second part. And these things, of course, they are just the opposite inverses of each other. Avoiding the bad and developing the good, they always come together in this way. Just like the five hindrances are like the inverse of the seven factors of awakening. As you diminish the five hindrances, you increase the seven factors of awakening. They are kind of, they go together like that. So we will talk more about the seven factors of awakening later on. So I think I will just leave it at that. Investigation of principles may not be very clear to you what that means, but I will get back to that later on. But one thing it means, it just means investigating the mental content, so that you know what is bad and what is good in your mind, so you understand the defilements and you're able to distinguish the defilements from the pure states of mind. That's one of the things it means. But actually, it also means more than that. And that is a sequence. The factors of awakening are a sequence, one thing leading to the next one all the way up. So if you get the beginning of a sequence going, then the sequence tends to develop by itself. And then you have that sequence again that we looked at yesterday. You rely on seclusion, fading away, and cessation. Yeah, this is how these factors of awakening are developed. Because if you want to have real samadhi, if you want to have success in the meditation practice, then you need some degree of seclusion. That's why we come out here to Anglesey, to get a little bit of seclusion from the ordinary life. And then you need some of this fading away and cessation of things, so that things become more clear. The more things fade away, the more focused you are on simple things. Yeah, the more the body fades away, the less is left of experience, the more ability you have to focus on that which remains, which often is a very simple, simple thing. Just the breath, or just joy, or whatever it is. That's why these things are important. And eventually, the ripen in letting go, it says here, vasagga parinama, vasagga of letting go, or relinquishment, or giving up. In other words, craving comes to an end. Okay, effort to develop. Yeah, these are examples, but obviously some of the most important examples. And what the mend against is an effort to preserve. So once you have developed something, how do you keep it going? It's when a mendicant preserves a meditation subject that is a good foundation for samadhi, the perception of a skeleton, the worm-infested corpse, the livid corpse, the split-open corpse, the bloated corpse. This is called the effort to preserve. These are four efforts. So here you have the meditation on the corpse. Yeah, it's one of the Satipatthana meditations. It is not mentioned all that often in the sutta. It is one of the few places where it is mentioned. You can substitute there, for example, the mindfulness of breathing. You could say a meditation sutta that is a foundation for samadhi, such as mindfulness of breathing. You could put that in there instead. And that would be more typical of how meditation progresses in according to the suttas. So here, they just use the perception of the corpse, just for a bit of fun, I suppose, a bit of alternative, more interesting, yeah? The breath gets a bit boring, corpses are pretty exciting for comparison. So here we have the idea, you preserve the meditation subject. Now, the word for meditation subject in the Pali is samadhi nimitta. Yeah, nimitta is a word that we will hear very often in Buddhist circles. Usually it's pronounced nimitta, but really the proper pronunciation is nimitta, is really the proper pronunciation. But anyway, that word usually in Buddhist circles is used to mean like a mental image that you have. Yeah, when your samadhi gets deep, when you start to become peaceful, mindfulness arises, and mind becomes powerful, often you get a mental image. And these mental images can take various forms. But one of the forms of the mental image is like a bright light in the mind. Like someone flashing a flashlight into your eyes, or you're seeing the sun or something like that. Very powerful. And this is often how it is used in a modern context. Or a nimitta can be used in the sense of just seeing anything in your mind, having visions, various kinds of visions. You have seen kind of amazing things. The mind is very creative, and I'm sure some of you, perhaps many of you, have had these kind of things happen in your meditation practice. Where you see things, and you wonder, oh, what's going on? What am I seeing? And usually, what you see is nothing to worry about. It's just your mind creating stuff. And all you have to do is just to carry on watching your breath, and eventually these visions will calm down, and you become more focused. So this is how nimitta is used in contemporary Buddhist circles. But really what it means in the sutta, it means like the object or the subject of your meditation. And here, the object is the corpse, or the skeleton. So use that as a subject or an object of your meditation practice. That is how it is used, the word nimitta in the sutta. So Satipatthana, for example, is also a nimitta of samadhi. You practice Satipatthana because it is the object or the subject that leads to samadhi practice. It's useful to know these things because sometimes you hear people use words like samadhi nimitta, and how they use it in contemporary Buddhism, how it is used in the suttas. often doesn't tally, and because it doesn't tally, it can be hard to work out what is being talked about. So good to know that difference. It's a fine foundation for immersion, fine bhadraka, bhadra. Bhadra is the same word as bhadra, so it's quite nice then. So it's good, it's a fine foundation for immersion. Then you have these things, and you may wonder, how do these things lead to samadhi? How can you kind of be investigating a corpse and that kind of lead to samadhi? And the reason is because when you focus on the corpse, the purpose of this is to abandon attachment to the body. Yeah? So here it is presumed that you already have a good mindfulness established already. Now, if you haven't got good mindfulness, there's not much point in doing the corpse meditation. Now, if your mindfulness is good, if your kind of your samadhi or your ability to focus on the breath or whatever, it comes to a plateau, you can't really go any further. The reason why it plateaus is because there's usually some sort of attachment there that stops you from going further. And you may not even be aware of what it is. It feels like the meditation is going well, you feel like everything is going fine, and then it kind of stops. Why is it stopping? Why is it going further? Well, usually, and you need to investigate that. It can be very hard to see, but usually something to do with attachment to the body or attachment to the five senses. Yeah? To go really deep in meditation, you have to give up the senses completely, as if you don't have them anymore, as if you're never going to see again in the rest of your life. That is kind of scary. It's like you're going blind. Yeah? It's like you're going deaf and blind. And to do that, you need it takes time to accustom you to be able to give up these things so profoundly, as if you're never going to be able to get these things back together. But eventually, you can do that. And this is one of the ways to aid us, to help us to give up these things, so we can take the meditation deeper. But now we're already talking about very deep states of meditation, yeah? And then, because it has this counteracting effect for attachment to the body, you release that attachment, and then it allows you to go deeper into samadhi as a consequence. This is the purpose of these kind of contemplations. In particular, the skeleton contemplation is sometimes to use. It can be quite a useful one. You contemplate the skeleton, and the skeleton is kind of quite beautiful in some ways. Yeah, it can be quite wide. It can give rise to kind of a beautiful image, especially when you. That mind is quite pure and your mindfulness is strong, and then the skeleton can eventually turn into another of these bright lights or whatever, and then of course it becomes very joyful. It's a very joyful skeleton. In the world, skeletons are scary. Skeletons are like, you know, ghosts and skeletons. In Buddhism, skeletons are joyful. It's kind of the alternative way of looking at it there. And actually, you know, skeletons, you know, we carry them with us all the time anyway. It's right here, it's the skeleton is here. How scary can it be here? Yeah, it's not as if it's all that foreign to us. That is how you use this practice to preserve. So here it means that you stay with the object, you don't allow it to go there, and as you stay with it, you have all these benefits arising from that. Those are the four life efforts, you will see that they are very broad. They go from overcoming defilements all the way to attaining the highest kind of samadhi. The four life effort is something that you take with you on the path. Starting with overcoming defilements all the way to the end. So they encompass really the last three factors of the path in a way. In this, when you look at it like this. And then, of course, the idea of the four-eyed efforts is that they then lead on to these other factors. So if you purify the mind in the right way, there comes a point when mindfulness becomes quite strong. And when mindfulness reaches a certain strength, like the mind is quiet, the mind is quite clear, when you have the ability to watch the breath, that's really what we mean by mindfulness, without too much distraction, then you go from right effort, you go into right samadhi, right sati, right mindfulness. So that is like when you move from one to the next one. But they are both go together, but there also is a movement from one to the other one. So because of that, I am now going to move on to the next set of these four Vipassana mantra. The next set is the four applications of mindfulness. So we have now purified the mind, we've got to that stage where mindfulness is possible, and that is where this happens. So, first of all, a bit of background again, and another extract from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha's passing away. And this is just to give you a feeling for what Satipatthana practice and Samasati is on the Buddhist path. Right mindfulness, in other words. This is what the Buddha says. I'm advanced in years. I have reached the final stage of life. I'm currently 80 years old. Just as a decrepit car keeps going while relying on straps, in the same way, the realized one's body, in other words, the Buddha's body, keeps going while relying on straps, or so it seems, or so you think. Sometimes the realized one, not focusing on any signs, and with a cessation of certain feelings, enters and remains in the signless immersion of heart, the signless stillness of heart. Only then does the realized one's body become comfortable. So here, you have the Buddha coming towards the very end of his life. Yeah, he's, as I mentioned before, he's on the way to his final destination at Susinara, where he is, will eventually pass away. And here, you can see, he is just like any other old person, yeah? The body is falling apart, things don't really work anymore. You have to hold it all together by the straps, as it says here. This is a metaphor for kind of the body falling apart, I suppose. And he had lots of pain, yeah? The pain only ceases when he enters deep meditation. That's what he's saying here. Here, the type of meditation is a signless samadhi. You don't need to worry too much about that. It's a kind of special form of samadhi that is attainable by arahants, by relying on things like non-self. But it's a deep kind of samadhi. And only then, when you go beyond the body, does the body stop having all these painful feelings. Yeah, I'm sure all of you will agree that all of you get the more painful feelings you have in the body. Yeah, this is how it goes for this body. So those of you who are young, that's what you're looking forward to, is more and more pain in the body. So, and for those of us who are kind of slowly getting there, we have even more to look forward to in the future. Which is kind of a nice thing to remember that. The interesting thing about this is that one of the important things that I have always found so important with the Sutta is to humanize the Buddha. Remember that the Buddha is just another human being, just like all of us. And when you humanize the Buddha, his teachings become far more powerful. Because he was a human being speaking to other human beings. So he was speaking to his, people who were just like him. And when you read the suttas, it becomes quite clear that the Buddha was human just like the rest of us. Sometimes you see supernormal things, and some of those supernormal things are not really, don't really belong there. And you can know that through comparative study of the suttas and all these kind of things. But the message that comes out of the sutras is that the Buddha was human. Before his awakening, he had defilements just like everyone else. He had wrong view just like everyone else. All of these things are founded in the sutras. Yeah, he had a child. Yeah, even when he was before his awakening. And then after his awakening, still his body, even though he's mentally changed, his body is still a human body. It deteriorates just like any other body has. Yeah, and this is such an important thing to remember, because sometimes we put the Buddha on the wrong kind of pedestal. We put the Buddha on the golden pedestal, or the kind of the pedestal of something that is completely different from us, but when really he should be on the pedestal of a human being that has taken the human potential to the highest. That is the right pedestal. Exceptional human being pedestal, not the god pedestal. You've got to get the pedestal right. Make sure you label your pedestals right. Is this one here? Is it like a pedestal over here? Is that labeled correctly? I can't pass out from here. But remember, the label matters. Yeah, it matters how we regard the Buddha. You get it wrong, and it destroys so much of the purpose and the beauty of these teachings. Because they become less applicable and less useful for us if it comes from something which is different from us. So again, but I think that is an important point. But of course, what also is happening here, the background behind all of this is that the Buddha is about to pass away. Just before this, the Buddha had just spent the rains retreat in Vesala that we talked about yesterday. And during that rains retreat, the Buddha almost died. He says to himself, oh, I've got to kind of, you know, get my act together because I can't die before I have made some kind of declaration to the Sangha. I've got to kind of say goodbye, first of all, to everyone before I die. I can't just die just like that. So the Buddha picks up his energy and kind of postpones his death moment a little bit. Yeah, that's what he does during the rains retreat. But he almost dies. Because he almost dies, Venerable Ananda, who is his attendant, is very worried. He sees the Buddha being really, you know, really being ill and really being almost passing away. And then he almost, you know, he feels as if he's like a drunkard. I lost my bearing, you know, up from down and down from up. And this is kind of the context of what comes now. Because the problem, of course, is that the reason why you feel like a drunkard when someone is passing away is because you are attached to that person. Yeah, it's difficult for you to deal with the Buddha passing away. And you can imagine if the Buddha is passing away, it's going to have some kind of impact. Here is the person who everyone has been looking to for advice, for understanding, for regulations, for everything, for 45 years. 45 years he's been the head of the Sangha, and everyone has always been going to him. And suddenly, he's about to pass away. You can imagine the vacuum, you can imagine the problem. Yeah, when someone like that is about to disappear. It's a bit like, you know, even now, even in the present day, we have certain people who are very crucial to Buddhism, and when they pass away, it's inevitable, because you know what's going to happen. You can imagine it. And for Tibetan Buddhists, when the Dalai Lama passes away, it's going to be difficult for them because he is such so incredibly prominent in Tibetan Buddhism. In the Theravada Buddhism, it's a bit more decentralized. You don't have people who are quite that big Theravada Buddhist overall. But like the Buddhist Society of WA, we have Ajahn Brahm. If Ajahn Brahm is gone, it's going to be different. Yeah? It's going to be scary. What's going to happen when he goes? Is everything going to collapse? Maybe, yeah, maybe that's the end of things. Maybe everything is going to collapse. Who knows what's going to happen? And this is the idea of impermanence, things being unreliable. We don't know what's going to happen next. And this sets the context for what the Buddha is about to say now. Yeah, so this is kind of the background for this. And the Buddha then says that the body is falling apart. So, Ananda, be your own island, your own refuge. We know of the refuge. Let the teaching be your island and your refuge. We know of the refuge. And how does a mendicant do this? So before I go on about how this is done, I think you know already how it's done, but this is such an important point. Yeah, the idea of being your own refuge, you know, of the refuge, taking the Dhamma as your refuge. And the point of this is that the external world, everything in the world around us is inherently unreliable. Everything. Yeah, everything you experience in this world. And we are so immersed in this world of the five senses. It's pretty much all we know. And perhaps only occasionally when you go on a meditation retreat, and you withdraw a little bit from that world, you withdraw into yourself, you get some respite, a respite from that world of the five senses. Yeah, we're so immersed in it, it's almost everything that we know. But the problem with that world is that it is so utterly unreliable. And it's useful to contemplate a little bit to the degree to which it is unreliable. You know, one of the a very superficial way of saying that is just when you kind of watch the news on TV or something like that, and then you see the news and you think, oh no, what's going on in this world? What's going on with the environment? What's happening with all the plastic in the ocean, with all the whales that are kind of full of plastic and these kind of things? It's kind of very unpleasant. Yeah, when you see that. Or you see that perhaps there are certain politicians you don't like, you think, well, these politicians getting elected. All they're doing is messing up the world even more. Yeah, and you kind of get upset when you see some of these things on TV, and or you read about it in the paper, or wherever you get your information from. And that already shows you the problem with the world outside. It is inherently unreliable. Then you expect the world to go in a certain way. Then you expect the politicians to be wise and clever. Then, but the politicians are often just a bit like us. Yeah, they don't have sometimes they're maybe a bit smarter. In some way, they might be more stupid. Who knows? But they're a bit like us. And they try their best, perhaps in their own little ways, to run the world in the right way. But because ultimately they are a bit clueless, just like all of us, that it tends to go, often it goes wrong, sometimes it goes right. But the point is, we don't know what's going to happen with the world. The world is out of control. We can't control it. We have to expect the world to do weird things. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it goes wrong. But every time you open a newspaper, every time you turn on the television, you should expect something bad to happen, yeah? Because that is the nature of things. Something you don't like, yeah? And this is just begins, yeah? It's a starting point for understanding how unreliable everything is. It's never going to go the way you want it to go. Why do you get upset when you see something in the world that goes against the way you want it to go? And the reason is because you're taking refuge in the world. Taking refuge in the world means you are expecting things in the world. You're expecting the world to go in a certain way. That's what taking refuge in the world means. But taking refuge in the world is foolish. It is foolish because it is inherently out of control. So this is just a beginning point for understanding that if we rely on the world outside, we are asking for suffering. Yeah? So every time you had some kind of expectation of the world, you're really asking for suffering. Yeah. That is just the beginning. That is kind of the big world outside there. But it is equally true of your own personal world, the world of your family, the world of your work, the world of everything around you that you own, all the things in your life. But all of those things are equally inherently problematic, yeah. Equally inherently out of control. And ultimately, everything is going to let you down there. All of these things have to disappear. Gradually they decline. Gradually people die, they divorce you, they let you down in one way or another. Eventually your own body lets you down. Yeah, eventually you're going to have to die. So everything in that physical world basically has to let you down in the end. So why is it then that we still keep on looking for so much happiness, for so many things in the external world? Why is it? And the reason is because we haven't really reflected on these things properly. We haven't really taken it on board. We haven't understood the Buddhist idea of impermanence. This is what this idea is, that everything is inherently unreliable. And once you get that, you start to look for your refuge in a different place. You can't take refuge in a place that is always going to let you down. That's madness, because that refuge will not actually work out. You take refuge somewhere else. And that is what the Buddha is saying here. Be an island unto yourself. Be your own island. Take the Dhamma as the island. That is where your refuge should be. Yeah? You go into yourself. You use meditation practice. You pursue a spiritual path in life. That is where the refuge is to be found. And in a sense, it is very obvious that this is true. I'm sure all of you can relate to what I'm saying because it just is. This is obvious that this is the way the world works. But notice your reactions. Yeah, when you go back home or when you think about things going wrong or whatever, notice your reactions. And then when you see that you are a bit upset about something, yes, understand that you're taking refuge in the wrong place. You're asking from the world what the world can never give you, which is one of those things that Adam Brown likes to say. And it's a beautiful thing saying it, because actually the world can never give you those things that you are seeking from it. So how do we find that refuge within ourselves? And this is then what the Buddha says next. So how do you do this? How can you be an island, your own island? It is when a mendicant or anyone meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware, mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. When they meditate, observing aspects of feelings, an aspect of mind, an aspect of principles, keen, aware, mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. That is how a mendicant is their own island, their own refuge. We know of the refuge. That is how the teaching is, the island, the refuge, window of the refuge. So here, you are practicing Sati, you're practicing the four Satipatthanas, and one way of doing that is to practice mindfulness of breathing, and yeah, it's one of the main Satipatthana methods. When Satipatthana is well established, it is like you go inside yourself a little bit, inside your own cocoon, yeah, and you kind of, the world outside becomes less important, your body, all of these things kind of recede into the background. They don't really matter anymore. And you actually do feel a bit like a refuge within that. And you are inside of yourself, but you feel kind of secure from the external world, because you have another source of happiness, another source of peace, another source of all of these positive things. It is within yourself. So when the meditation works, yeah, and you start to feel joy and happiness and all of these kind of things, you really are finding that refuge. And one of those nice sayings by Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah being, of course, Ajahn Brahm's teacher, one of the most famous forest monks in Thailand in the 20th century, and he said that meditation or samadhi is your real home. This is where it is your home. This is where you find real refuge from the world. Yeah? Not just your ordinary home, but your home inside it when you practice meditation in this way. So that is where the deeper your meditation goes, the more powerful that refuge is, the more liberated you are from the world outside, because you're starting to find happiness in new places, in places where you didn't even know there was such a thing as happiness. And then the impermanence of the world, the problems outside, they don't bother you so much anymore. You still do your little bit to help the world, you do what you can, but you realize that you can only do so much. And for the rest of it, you have to let it go, and you have to find a refuge elsewhere, because it is inherently out of control. So just briefly, what are these four Satipatthanas? Because this is, I think, the only place where we come across them. Just to very briefly, just comment on what is mentioned here. So you observe an aspect of the body. Yeah, this is a nice translation for kaya, kaya nupasti, which is often translated in weird ways, like you observe the body as a body. But an aspect of the body is good. It means that there are a number of different exercises you can do. So you focus on one aspect, the breath, the 31 parts, the four elements, that kind of thing. And then you have this adjectives here that describe how the practice is to be done. Yeah, you are keen, aware, mindful. And keen here is artapi. This means like you have energy. Yeah, you have effort. Artapi is a word which is almost synonymous with energy and effort. Energy being virya and effort being padana. And it's somewhere in between those two words. The difference between effort and energy is that effort means that you are applying yourself, whereas energy is a natural energy in the mind that occurs when you reach a certain stage of your practice. Yeah? One is applying yourself, the other one is just the energy is already there, you don't really need to apply yourself anymore in the same way. And antapi is somewhere kind of in between those. So already at this stage, you have a degree of energy in the mind. The reason why you have energy is because the defilements have largely been subdued, yeah, they're not so strong anymore. And when the defilements are gone, the energy comes automatically into your mind. The less defilements you have, the more energy you have. This is why people who have gone a long way on the path, they usually have lots of energy to them. You can see some people that are bubbling with energy, yes. Those are the people who are, usually they have less defilements, that's why you have more energy here. You are aware, this is sampajanya, and the word sampajanya is an important one in the Buddhist practice, and it means that you are aware of whether the practice is heading in the right direction. Yeah, it is often said in the suttas, you are aware of the suitability and aware of the purpose, so you know whether you actually are applying your mind in the right way. If you're watching the breath, you know, am I watching the breath correctly? Is it leading to the right results? Or am I sitting here thinking about all sorts of things? Yeah, and if you know that you're watching the breath and you're doing it in a kind of nice and easy way, in the right way, then the Sampajanya is what informs you that you're doing things in a way that leads towards the goal, and it leads towards a more profound state of meditation. Sampajanya is like a wisdom aspect, awareness and wisdom coming together. You know what you're doing there. Sampajanya is also very important in ordinary life, yeah? The things that you're doing in ordinary life, are they suitable? Are they appropriate? Yeah, so, you know, there are many things that are not appropriate and not going to lead to wholesome state. They're going to lead to all kinds of problems. So you need to distinguish that and you know whether you're doing the right thing or not. That's Sampajanya. Then you have mindfulness, Satimata. Yeah, so you have to be mindful to practice Samma, Satina. So this shows that mindfulness already has to be established before you can do Satipatthana practice. Yeah, so we establish mindfulness first of all, then Satipatthana comes after that. And this is why foundations of mindfulness is actually a wrong translation, because it gives the wrong idea of what Satipatthana is about. And then you are rid of desire and aversion for the world. And what this means, it refers back to the sense restraint that we talked about yesterday. Because the sense restraint is what actually eliminates that desire and aversion for the world. So when you come to Satipatthana practice, when you come to Samasati, that has already been eliminated. And that's why it says here, rid of these things. So it refers to desire and aversion in relation to the five senses. That's what it refers to. Yeah, you don't have that desire and aversion anymore. This refers to fairly coarse aspect. It doesn't refer to the very refined things. Yeah, there are these things come in very refined forms, like, you know, attachments to the body, perhaps, that we cannot let go of as a meditation deepens, etc. This is more like the coarse things, the things that you restrain in daily life to avoid strong ill will and desires to arise. So your mind is quite even. So when you come to the meditation, your mind is already quite even, and then you just follow along from there. So the world here refers to the world of the five senses. The Pali word is loka, and the word loka in Pali is used almost exactly as we use the word world in English. Now when we say the world in English, it can mean many different things. It can mean the planet, it can mean humanity, it can mean the universe, depending on how we use it. It's exactly the same in Pali, so you have to kind of specify. But sometimes it means just the world of the five senses. And that is one of these worlds. And that is what it seems to mean in this particular context. So this is gives you some of the information you need to understand what Satipatthana is all about, yeah? These are the kind of preliminaries that you have to have in place for Satipatthana practice really to work. Yeah? And then you can start to understand why virtue is so important. Yeah, to be rid of aversion and desire for the world, well, that happens through virtue. It happens through living a moral life. It happens through the five precepts. It happens through being kind. It happens through being compassionate to other people, and also through a certain degree of restraint. So you stop yourself from getting angry and all of that. So virtue is absolutely fundamental. Without that, there's no way that you're going to have success in meditation practice. And it's so important to remember that. And very often it's not taught properly. Very often you kind of just push down on the seat and say, meditate, watch the breath. And you said, yes, sir. But you're not actually given any background information, not really told how this is supposed to happen. What is the context? And the context is that virtue is one of those contexts. There is another context, I'll come to that later on, but for now, that is the context that you require. So you observe the body in this way, you also observe feelings in this way. I'll show you how this works in practice later on. It is not exactly obvious how you are supposed to observe the feelings. But in context of anapanasati, watching the breath, it becomes very obvious what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to watch the aspects of the mind. So again, it is not exactly clear how we're supposed to do this. But that in the context of Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, it becomes very obvious what we are supposed to do. And the last one is aspects of principles. Principles here means, largely it means causality. It means that we understand how things come into being, and especially the things that we are concerned about are defilements, the five hindrances. How they come into being. Yeah, what is it that gives rise to these things? And the more we understand that cause of and conditioning process, the more ability we have to overcome these things. Yeah, and the same thing then with the seven awakening factors, we understand that also in terms of causality, so we understand how these things come into being. What is it that causes mindfulness? What is it that causes piti and joy to happen? All of these things. And then we have an ability to give rise to these things because we understand this. And all of this happens as part of meditation practice. Yeah? So part of the meditation practice is just to watch the breath then. But an important aspect of the meditation practice is also to contemplate afterwards how the process unfolds. And you may have noticed, I often say at the end of the guided meditation, reflect a little bit on what is happening there. Because when you reflect, you actually understand how it works. What is it that you understand? Well, you understand, now I feel peaceful. How can I feel peaceful now that I didn't do before? And then you realize that you just relaxed, you just didn't do anything in particular, and suddenly peace arises out of that. So you start to understand the nature of letting go. You start to understand the kind of perception that leads you in the right direction. Yeah? This is what you should look out for at the end of the meditation practice. And then you start to understand what is happening there. And this is part of this idea of investigation of principles, understanding the causality of these things. These things are very practical, and if they sound theoretical, then that is my fault for not making them practical enough, but they're actually very practical. These are the things that you apply in your meditation practice. Okay, so let's finish off this paragraph. The Buddha said, that's how you have this teaching as your island, the teaching as your refuge. And of course, the reason why the teaching is your refuge is because you are using the Dhamma to guide you all along. So you are your own refuge by going inside of yourself, but you use the teaching as a guide in all of this. Whether now, after I have passed, any one who shall live as their own island, their own refuge, with no other refuge, with the teaching as their island and the refuge, with no other refuge. Those mendicants of mine who want to train shall be among the best of the best. And the idea there is just that if you practice Satipatthana properly, and you do the mindfulness of breathing in the right way by investigating all of this, then you will have success. Yeah, and you will be a light in the world, and you will help others to also practice the same path. And what a wonderful thing that is. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Okay, so that is all for now. A little bit of Satipatthana practice, let us continue this at 3 o'clock this afternoon. So see you again at 3 o'clock.